You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a set of essays by Rudolf Steiner that were introductions to Goethe's scientific writings, entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is chapter 17, entitled Goethe versus Atomism, number 1. There is a great deal of talk these days about the progress of natural science in the 19th century. I believe that one can really only speak in this regard of significant scientific experience and how it has changed practical life. But when it comes to the fundamental conceptions through which modern science tries to understand the realm of experience, I must say that I consider them unhealthy and untenable when subjected to rigorous thinking. This view was expressed most recently by the well-known chemist Wilhelm Ostwald, footnote, Friedrich Wilhelm Ostwald, 1853 to 1932, German physical chemist who helped to establish physical chemistry as a specific scientific discipline. He is credited with the law of dilution of an electrolyte, 1888, researched the electrical conductivity of organic acids, developed a quantitative color theory, invented a process of preparing nitric acid by oxidizing ammonia. His lecture, Overcoming Scientific Materialism, was presented to the Association of German Scientists and Doctors, Lübeck, September 20, 1895, shortly before this chapter was written. Editor and a footnote. According to him, quote, when asked, subquote, how do you conceive of the inner makeup of the world? Close subquote. Every thoughtful scientist, from mathematicians to practicing physicians, will say that things are made up of moving atoms, and that those atoms and the forces acting between them are the ultimate realities. From these, individual phenomena appear. We have all heard it said hundreds of times that this is the only way to understand the physical world, that we must revert to the mechanics of atoms. Matter and motion seem to be the only concepts from which the whole multiplicity of natural phenomena can be derived. One might call this view scientific materialism. Close quote. I wrote in the previous chapter that the fundamental views of contemporary physicists are untenable. Ostwald concurs, quote, this mechanistic view of the world does not serve the purpose for which it was designed. It contradicts inarguable, well-known, and accepted truths. Close quote. This agreement continues. I say, quote, the sense-perceptible world, as it presents itself to us, is an aggregate of metamorphosing perceptions without an underlying material substratum. Close quote from page 175. And Ostwald says, quote, when we realize that everything we know about a material relates to its properties, it becomes clear that it is ridiculous to assert that a certain material is present, but without any of its properties. The only utility of such a purely formal assumption is in creating an agreement between general facts of chemical processes, in particular the stoichiometric laws of mass, and an arbitrary concept of immutable matter. Close quote. And in the present book, quote from Steiner, I believe, these are the considerations that forced me to consider any theory of nature to be impossible that on principle goes beyond the realm of the perceived world, and that have led me to embrace the sensory world as the only object of natural science. Close quote, page 165 of this book. And Ostwald's lecture, quote, what is our experience of the physical world? It is obviously no more than what our sensory organs give us. The task of science is to gather realities, provable and measurable quantities, and to discover their interrelationships, so that when one is given, the other will result. And this must be done not by postulating hypothetical models, but by verifying the interdependent aspects of measurable quantities. Close quote. If we ignore the fact that Ostwald speaks from the perspective of contemporary science, and consequently sees only the measurable aspects of the sensory world, His statement here coincides with mine. Quote, theory must encompass what is perceptible by the eye and look for the interrelationships within this realm. Close quote from page 189. In my discussion of Goethe's theory of color, I fight the same battle as Professor Ostwald's lecture against the intellectual foundations of conventional science. It is true that I focus on concepts that do not entirely agree with Ostwald's ideas, because, as I will show, he proceeds from the same superficial assumptions as the scientific materialists he opposes. I have also demonstrated that the faulty foundations of the modern view of nature are responsible for the unhealthy assessments of Goethe's color theory. Let me proceed in greater detail with my discussion of the modern view of nature. To assess the soundness of this view, I will consider the goal it has set itself. One finds in Descartes, not without justification, the basic formula that the modern view of nature has adopted to judge the perceptible world. Quote, when I consider physical things more closely, there is little in them that I can grasp clearly and distinctly. Magnitude, or extension in length, breadth, and depth, form, which results from the termination of extension, the location of bodies of diverse forms with reference to one another, and motion, or the change of location, to which may be added substance, duration, and number. But light, colors, sounds, odors, tastes, heat, cold, and the other tactile qualities, smoothness, roughness, enter my mind with such obscurity and confusion that I am unable to determine whether they are true or false. In other words, whether or not the ideas I have of these qualities are in truth the ideas of real objects, or only represent fantastic things that could never exist. From Descartes' Meditations, Part 3, end of quote. This statement of Descartes represents what has become the habitual thinking of today's scientists, so much so that to them any other way of thinking is really not worth considering. They say, we perceive light as the result of a kinetic process that can be expressed mathematically. When a color appears, they trace it to a vibration and calculate the number of waves per second. They believe that the whole sensory world will be explained when we can trace every perception back to relationships that can be expressed mathematically. According to this view, a mind that could provide such explanations would have achieved the highest possible insight into the natural world. Dubois-Raymond, a good example of such scientists, says of such a mind, quote, for it the hairs on our heads would be numbered, and not a single sparrow would fall to the ground without its knowledge. Close quote. Footnote. Über die Grenzen der Natur kennens, On the Limits of Natural Science, Leipzig, 1882, page 13, Dubois-Raymond, 1818 to 1896, German physiologist and professor in Berlin, best known for his research in animal electricity, physiology of muscles and nerves, and metabolic processes, editor, end of footnote. To treat the world as a mathematical exercise is the ideal of conventional science. Because there is no way for the parts of hypothetical matter to begin moving without the intervention of external forces, modern scientists make forces themselves into elements that can be used to explain the world. As Dubois-Raymond puts it, quote, to know nature means to trace changes within material bodies to the movements of atoms caused by their central forces that are independent of time, which means understanding natural processes in terms of the mechanics of atoms. Close quote, Ibid, page 10. Through the introduction of the concept of force, mathematics becomes mechanics. Today, philosophers are so deeply influenced by scientists that they have lost all courage to think independently. They do not hesitate to accept the views of scientists. Wilhelm Wundt, one of the most respected German philosophers, says, quote, in keeping with and applying the principle that given the qualitative immutability of matter, all natural processes ultimately consist of motion, the goal of physics is its translation into applied mechanics. Close quote. From Logic, 1830-1833, footnote, Wilhelm Wundt, 1832-1920, physiologist, psychologist, and founder of experimental psychology. A student of Johannes Müller, he headed the first psychological laboratory. Editor, end of footnote. Dubois-Raymond finds it a matter of psychological experience that, quote, achieving such a resolution, that is, reducing natural processes to the mechanics of atoms, close parenthesis, always temporarily satisfies our need for causal explanation, close quote. This may well be a matter of experience for Dubois-Raymond, but it must be said that there are others who are unsatisfied with such banal explanations of the physical world. One such person is Goethe. Anyone whose need for causal explanation is satisfied by reducing natural processes to the mechanics of atoms is incapable of understanding Goethe. Subpart 2. Size, form, position, motion, force, and so on are just as much sensations as, for example, light, color, sound, smell, taste, cold, or heat. Any time we consider the size of a thing isolated from its other characteristics, we are no longer dealing with the actual thing, but with an intellectual abstraction. It makes no sense to attribute to an abstraction from sensory experience a higher degree of reality than to a sense-perceptible thing itself. The only advantage of employing spatial and numerical relationships rather than other sensory perceptions lies in their greater simplicity and the greater ease of surveying them at a glance. Mathematical science gains its certainty from such simplicity and surveyability. Modern science always reduces physical processes to mathematical and mechanical terms because of the ease and convenience with which they can be manipulated. Human thinking prefers convenience. This comes to expression in Ostwald's lecture, quoted from above. This scientist wants to replace matter and force with energy. Listen to him. Quote, "What is the factor that determines when one of our senses becomes active? No matter how we look at it, all we find is this. The instruments of our senses react to energy differentials between themselves and their environment. If we lived in a world where the temperature was always that of our body, we would never know anything about warmth, just as we have no experience of the constant atmospheric pressure under which we live. Only when the pressure changes do we become aware of it. Just imagine someone hitting you with a stick. What is it that you feel, the stick or its energy? We must answer, its energy, because the stick is the most harmless thing in the world, as long as it is not being swung. But you will reply that we can bump into a resting stick. This is true. But what we experience is, as I said, an energy differential with our sensory apparatus. And from this perspective, it makes no difference whether the stick strikes against us or we move into it. If they both moved at the same speed in the same direction, the stick would no longer exist from the point of view of our feeling sense, because it could not contact us and effect an exchange of energy." Close quote. Here Ostwald is isolating energy from the realm of perceptions, that is, isolating it from everything that is not energy. He reduces all perceptions to a single characteristic of the perceptible world, the expression of energy, and thus to an abstraction. The extent to which Ostwald is caught in current scientific habits is very obvious. If we were to ask him, the only justification he could find for his approach is that it is a fact of psychological experience, that his need for causal explanation is satisfied by reducing the processes of nature to exchanges of energy. In fact, it makes no difference whether Dubois-Raymond resorts to the mechanics of atoms or Ostwald to exchanges of energy. In either case, the human need for mental convenience is satisfied. Ostwald ends his lecture by saying, quote, "No matter how necessary and useful energy may be for understanding nature, is it enough to explain the physical world? Or are there phenomena that cannot be wholly represented by currently known laws of energy? I feel a need to be as responsible in answering this question as I have been in the rest of my presentation today. And I must emphasize that the answer is no. Irrespective of the tremendous advantages of explaining the world in terms of energy, as opposed to materialistic or mechanistic explanations, in my opinion, there are already several cases that cannot be explained by the known laws of energy. These point to the existence of principles that go beyond them. Energetics will survive side by side with these new laws. But in the future, it will not be, as we think of it now, the most comprehensive principle for the mastery of natural phenomena. Rather, it will probably be seen as merely a special expression of more general relations, whose form we can barely imagine today. Close quote. Subpart 3. If our scientists also read the writings of those who are not part of their club, Professor Ostwald could never have made such a remark. For, as early as 1891, in my introduction to Goethe's color theory, I wrote that we can very well imagine such, in quotes, forms, and that science in the future will have the task of elaborating on Goethe's fundamental scientific ideas. We can no more reduce physical processes to the mechanics of atoms than to states of energy. Such reductionism serves only to divert our attention from the content of the real sensory world, directing it instead toward abstractions whose impoverished qualities are nevertheless ultimately taken from that sensory world. We cannot explain one group of sensory qualities, light, color, sound, smell, taste, warmth, and so on, by reducing them to another group of sensory qualities, size, form, location, number, energy, and so on. The task of natural science cannot be to reduce one category of qualities to another. Rather, it must find the connection and relationships among the perceptible qualities of the world. When we do this, we discover particular conditions under which one sensory perception leads with necessity to another. We discover that particular phenomena are more intimately connected than others. We establish connections that are more than the haphazard results of random observation. We recognize that particular relationships are necessary and others are coincidental. Goethe calls necessary relationships between phenomena archetypal phenomena. We know that we are dealing with an archetypal phenomenon when we can say that one sensory perception inevitably gives rise to another. This is what we call a natural law. For example, when we say that, quote, objects expand when heated, close quote, we have expressed a lawful relationship between phenomena of the sensory world, warmth and expansion. We have identified an archetypal phenomenon and expressed it as a natural law. Archetypal phenomena correspond to what Ostwald was seeking, those forms that express the most universal relationships within inorganic nature. The laws of mathematics and mechanics, like laws that formulate other sensory relationships, are also only expressions of archetypal phenomena. Kirchhoff is mistaken when he says that the task of mechanics is to describe natural motions in, quote, the simplest and most complete way. Footnote, Gustav Robert Kirchhoff, 1824-1887, German physicist and professor in Heidelberg and Berlin. Kirchhoff's laws allow for the circulation of currents, voltages, and resistances of electrical networks. He helped to discover a method of spectral analysis that led to the discovery of cesium, 1860, and rubidium, 1861. He also researched the sun's composition. Editor end of footnote. Mechanics not only describes natural motions in the simplest and most complete way, but also looks for certain necessary motions within the sum total of motions occurring in nature. It then formulates these necessary motions as fundamental mechanical laws. Only extreme thoughtlessness can account for the fact that this statement by Kirchhoff has been quoted repeatedly as tremendously significant, without the realization that the establishment of the simplest mechanical laws disproves it. The archetypal phenomenon represents a lawful relationship between elements of the phenomenal world. One can hardly say anything more inappropriate than Helmholtz did in a speech to the Weimar-Goethe Conference on June 11, 1892. Quote, "It is a shame that Goethe was unaware of Huygens' wave theory of light, which had already been established at the time. There he would have found a much more correct and concrete archetypal phenomenon," in quotes. Archetypal phenomenon, in quotes, than the hardly suitable and entangled process he selected for this purpose in the colors arising in turbid media. Close quote. Footnote, Goethe's Vorhandungen kommen der wissenschaftlicher Ideen, Berlin, 1892, page 34, Hermann Ludwig Ferdinand von Helmholtz, 1821-1894, physicist, anatomist, and physiologist, was a founder of the principle of conservation of energy. He determined the velocity of nerve impulses, invented the ophthalmoscope, and investigated the mechanisms of sight and hearing. Editor, end of footnote. It was a close quote. He claims that waves, which are imperceptible and constitute a speculative addition to the phenomenon of light, would have provided Goethe with a more correct and concrete archetypal phenomenon than does a process unfolding before our very eyes. This process is hardly complicated. Consisting as it does of light seen through a cloudy medium as yellow, and darkness seen through a lighted medium as blue. The, in quotes, reduction of sense-perceptible processes to imperceptible mechanical movements has become such a habit for modern physicists that they seem unaware of having replaced reality with an abstraction. Pronouncements like this by Helmholtz should be allowed only when statements of Goethe's, like the one below, have been refuted. Quote, "The highest achievement would be to understand that everything factual is already theory. The blue of the sky reveals to us the fundamental law of color. Do not look for anything behind the phenomena. They themselves are the theory." From Verses in Prose, close quote. Goethe remains within the realm of the phenomena. Modern physicists gather a few bits and pieces of the world and place them behind the phenomena in order to derive the phenomena of actually perceived experience from these hypothetical realities. Subpart 4. Certain young physicists claim that they do not make higher claims for the idea of material motion than for their sensory experience. One such individual is Anton Lampa, who has performed the remarkable feat of being both a mechanistic scientist and a follower of Indian mysticism. Footnote, see Knights of the Seeker, Braunschweig, 1893, Anton Lampa, 1868-1938, Austrian educator and pioneer of high-frequency spectroscopy. Editor, end of footnote. He argues against Ostwald's statements by saying that his battle with scientific materialism, quote, merely tilts at windmills. Where is the giant of scientific materialism? He does not even exist. Once upon a time there was the scientific materialism of Büchner, Feucht, and Molschat. There still is, but not in the natural sciences, because it is not at home there. This was overlooked by Ostwald, otherwise he would have taken a stand only against the mechanistic view. Because of his misunderstanding, however, he does this only incidentally. And if it had not been for his misunderstanding, he probably would not have done so at all. Is it possible, then, that following paths opened up by Kirchhoff, science can conceive of matter as materialism has done? Impossible. This is an obvious contradiction. The concept of matter, like that of force, takes on meaning only as precisely determined by the demand for the simplest possible description, or in Kantian terms, in an empirical sense. And if a scientist attaches further meaning to the word matter, he does so not as a scientist, but as a materialistic philosopher. Close quote. Footnote, Die Zeit, Vienna, November 30, 1895, Rudolf Steiner. End of footnote. Judging from these words, Lampe must be considered a typical scientist of our time. He uses the more convenient mechanistic explanations, but he avoids thinking any further about the real nature of such explanations, because he fears becoming entangled in contradictions that he cannot resolve. How is it possible for any clear-minded person to make sense of the concept of matter without going beyond the world of experience? In the experiential world, there are bodies of various sizes and positions. There are movements and forces. There are the phenomena of light, color, warmth, electricity, life, and so on. But experience does not tell us that size, warmth, color, and so on are attached to, in quotes, matter. Matter cannot be found in our experience. If we want to think matter, it must be thought up and added to our experience. This intellectual addition of matter to the phenomenally experienced world is noticeable in the physical and physiological deliberations so common today in natural science, as influenced by Kant and Johannes Müller. Footnote 1826, oh, excuse me, in 1826, Johannes Müller, 1801 to 1858, German psychologist and physiologist, proposed his theory of specific nerve energies, which stated that different nerves, optical, auditive, etc., carry a code that identifies their origin in the brain. Editor, end of footnote. They have led us to believe that the external events leading to sounds in the ear, light in the eye, or warmth in the organs sensitive to heat, are in no way related to the sensations of sound, light, and warmth. These external events are simply supposed to be specific movements of matter. Scientists determine what sort of external motions cause sound, light, or color to arise in the human soul. They conclude that red, yellow, or blue exist nowhere outside of the human organism, but that there is a wave-like motion of a subtle elastic matter, the ether, which is perceived as red, yellow, or blue when it is sensed through the eye. E.Y.E. If there were no eye to sense this, there would be no color, only the movement of ether. They claim that ether is an objective fact and that color is subjective and created within the human body. Professor Wundt of Leipzig, who is acclaimed as one of the greatest philosophers in Germany today, says that matter is a substrate, quote, never observable directly, but only through its effects, close quote. And he finds that, quote, any explanation of the phenomena that does not contradict itself, close quote, must assume such a substrate. Parenthesis, see Logic, Volume 2, close parenthesis. Descartes' delusion about clear and confused mental pictures has become a fundamental way of representing matters in physics. Subpart 5. Those whose capacity for forming a worldview has not been destroyed by Descartes, Locke, Kant, and modern physiology will never, let me read that again, those whose capacity for forming a worldview has not been destroyed by Descartes, Locke, Kant, and modern physiology will never understand how it is possible to conceive of light, color, sound, warmth, and so on as merely subjective states of the human organism, and at the same time claim that a completely objective world of processes exists outside the organism. If we claim that the human organism itself produces sound, color, and warmth, we must also say that it produces extension, magnitude, location, movement, forces, and so on. These mathematical and mechanical attributes are in fact inseparable from the rest of the perceptible world. Only abstract thinking separates the elements of space, number, motion, and the expressions of force from warmth, sound, color, and other sensory qualities. Mathematical and mechanical laws refer to abstract entities and processes drawn from the world of experience, and as such, they can therefore only be applied to the experienced world. But if we were to claim that mathematical and mechanical processes are also subjective, nothing would remain to serve as content for our concept of objective things and occurrences, and we cannot derive phenomena from empty concepts. Modern scientists and philosophers, their baggage carriers, cling to the idea that sensory perceptions are merely subjective states evoked by objective events. As long as this is so, healthy thinking must object that either they are playing with empty concepts, or else they attribute to the objective world a content borrowed from that part of the world. I have addressed this absurdity in several of my writings. Footnote: The Science of Knowing, Outline of an Epistemology Implicit in the Goethean Worldview, 1886, titled Truth and Science, 1892. Titled Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, A Philosophy of Freedom, formerly known as The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, 1894. Editor, end of footnote. I will not go into the question of whether wave processes and the forces that cause them, from which the most recent physics derives all natural phenomena, are to be ascribed to a different form of reality from that of sensory perceptions. I will simply ask, what is it that can be accomplished by mathematical and mechanistic views of nature? Anton Lampa's opinion is that, quote, mathematics as subject and mathematics as method are not the same, since mathematical methods can be applied without mathematics. Faraday, who could barely square a binomial, provides a classic example of this in his experimental investigations of electricity. Mathematics is simply a means of abbreviating logical processes, thus helping us with many complex matters that would prove too much for our usual modes of logical thinking. But mathematics does much more. To the extent that each formula expresses the process of its own becoming, it can build a living bridge to the elementary phenomena that served as the starting point of the investigation. Therefore, a method that cannot use mathematics, which is the case whenever magnitudes are immeasurable, must not only adhere to strict logic, if it is to use mathematical methodology, but it must also be very careful in following matters back to basic phenomena. Otherwise it goes astray, exactly where it lacks mathematical structure. When it achieves this, however, it may properly claim to be mathematical, as a distinction of its precision. From Knights of the Seeker, page 92, end of quote. I would not spend so much time with Lampa if he were not such a perfect example of the contemporary natural scientist. He satisfies his philosophical needs through Indian mysticism, which means that he does not muddle his mechanistic view of nature with all sorts of incidental philosophizing. The theory of nature he has in mind is, so to speak, the pure view of today's science. I find that Lampa has completely ignored an important characteristic of mathematics. True, every mathematical equation does, quote, build a living bridge, close quote, to the elementary phenomena that served as the starting point for an investigation. But the elementary phenomena are essentially the same as the more complex factors from which the bridge is built. Mathematicians trace the properties of complex spatial and numerical structures, as well as their mutual interrelationships, back to the properties and relationships of the most basic numerical and spatial structures. Mechanical engineers do the same in their field. They trace composite motions and forces back to simple, easily surveyable motions and forces. To do this, they employ mathematical laws, to the extent that movements and the effects of forces can be expressed in geometric and numerical equations. In a mathematical equation that expresses a mechanical law, the individual elements or equations are no longer purely mathematical patterns, but represent forces and motions. The relationships in which these formula are embedded are not determined by purely mathematical lawfulness, but by the actual properties of forces and movements. The minute we forget the specific meaning of these mechanical formula, we are no longer dealing with mechanical lawfulness, but only with mathematical lawfulness. The relationship between mechanics and mathematics is paralleled by that between physics and mechanics. The task of physicists is to trace the complicated processes of color, sound, warmth, electricity, magnetism, and so on, to simple occurrences within the same sphere. They must, for example, trace complicated color events to the simplest occurrences of color. In doing so, they must use mechanical and mathematical laws to the extent that color phenomena involve patterns that can be analyzed spatially and numerically. The mathematical method, when applied to physics, would mean investigating the connections among colors, sounds, and so on within those phenomena themselves, not tracing them back to forces and movements in matter devoid of color or sound. Modern physics bypasses sound, color, and other qualities as such, and examines only unchanging forces of attraction or repulsion and motions in space. Under the influence of this approach, physics has largely become a form of applied math and mechanics, and the other areas of science are headed in that direction as well. It is impossible to build a living bridge, in quotes, between the fact that a particular movement of colorless matter exists at a given location in space, and the fact that at another occasion, that at another location, someone sees red. Only motion can be derived from motion. Because there is a motion that affects the senses and consequently the brain, it follows, according to the mathematical and mechanical method, that the brain will be stimulated to respond with certain motions, but not that it will perceive actual colors, sounds, and so on. Dubois-Raymond had already acknowledged this when he asked, quote, "What relationship can there be between the motion of particular atoms in my brain on the one hand, and on the other the immediate, undefinable, but undeniable fact that I experience pain, pleasure, sweetness, the smell of a rose, organ music, or red? Motion can engender only motion." Close quote. Footnote. Title On the Limits of Scientific Knowledge, pages 35, 34, Rudolf Steiner, and a footnote. End of quote as well. Dubois-Raymond sees in this a limit to scientific knowledge. But the reason one cannot derive the experience of seeing red from a particular movement is, in my opinion, very easy to show. The quality, in quotes, red, and a certain process of motion are in reality an indivisible unity. The separation of the two occurrences can only be an intellectual, conceptual one. The particular motion that corresponds to the quality of red has no independent reality. It is an abstraction. It is just as absurd to attempt to derive the experience of seeing red from a process of motion as it would be to try to derive the actual properties of a cube-shaped salt crystal from the mathematical formula for the cube. It is not a limitation of our knowledge that prevents us from deriving other sensory qualities from motions. Attempting to do so simply makes no sense. Subsection 6. The desire to bypass colors, sounds, and warmth as such, and deal only with the corresponding mechanical processes, must arise from the notion that the simple laws of mathematics and mechanics are for some reason more easily understood than the characteristics and interrelationships of the other aspects of our perceptual world. But this is certainly not the case. We claim to have no difficulty in conceiving of the simplest properties and relationships in spatial and numerical configurations, because we can survey them easily and completely. All mathematical and mechanical understanding involves reducing matters to simple facts that can be understood as soon as we become aware of them. The statement that two values are equal to a third and therefore must also be equal to each other is understood immediately when we become aware of its content. Similarly, simple phenomena in the realm of sound, color, and other sensory perceptions are recognized through direct observation. Physicists exclude the specific qualities of sound and color from the realm of phenomena, and consider only their corresponding kinetic events, simply because their preconceptions lead them to believe that simple mathematical or mechanical facts are easier to understand than elementary perceptions of sound or color. And because they cannot conceive of motions without something that moves, they postulate a material devoid of all qualities as the carrier of motion. Only those who are imprisoned by this bias will fail to notice that kinetic states themselves are connected to sense-perceptible qualities. The contents of the oscillating motions that correspond to various sounds are the qualities of the sounds themselves. The same is true of all sensory qualities. Direct awareness, not the speculative addition of an abstract matter, allows us to recognize the content of the oscillating motions of the phenomenal world. Subsection 7. I know that what I say here must sound impossible to the ears of contemporary physicists, but I cannot accept Wundt's view that the thinking habits of modern scientists are the binding norms of logic, from Logic, Volume 2. The thoughtlessness of this assumption is particularly clear when he examines Ostwald's attempt to replace the idea of vibrating matter with the oscillating movement of energy. Wundt says, quote, "The existence of interference phenomena makes it necessary to assume a kind of oscillating motion. But since motion is unthinkable without a moving substrate, light phenomena must be traced back to some sort of mechanical process." However, Ostwald tried to elude this second assumption by defining radiant energy as matter in oscillating motion rather than as the vibrations of a material medium. In other words, we are looking at a two-sided concept that has a visible side and one that is wholly conceptual. The very presence of this ambiguity strikingly suggests that the concept of energy itself needs an analysis that leads back to observable elements. An actual motion can only be defined as a change of location of an actual substratum in space. The existence of that substratum can only be revealed either by the effects of the forces emanating from it, or by the functions of those forces we assume to be sustained by it. But it seems impossible to me that these functions of force, which can themselves only be grasped as concepts, can be conceived of as moving unless we postulate some sort of substratum. Close quote. Ostwald's concept of energy is much closer to actual reality than Wundt's allegedly, in quotes, real substrate. The perceived phenomena of light, warmth, electricity, magnetism, and so on can all be brought under the general concept of force output, or energy. When light or warmth, for example, trigger a change in a body, an energy output is effected. When we describe light or warmth as energy, in quotes, we disregard their specific qualities in favor of one general shared property. Such a property certainly does not exhaust all the aspects of reality, but it is a real property. On the other hand, the concept of the properties that physicists and their allies in philosophy have attributed to their hypothetical matter is inherently self-contradictory. These properties are borrowed from the sensory world, and yet they are supposed to apply to a substrate that is not a part of the sensory realm. It is inconceivable how Wundt can maintain that the concept of, quote, radiant energy, close quote, is impossible simply because it has two aspects, one physically observable and one that is conceptual. Wundt, the philosopher, fails to understand that all concepts related to sensory reality must contain both an observable and a purely conceptual element. The concept, quote, salt crystal cube, close quote, has the perceptible component of a salt crystal accessible to the senses, and a purely conceptual component established by solid geometry. Subsection 8. The evolution of natural science in recent centuries has led to the destruction of all conceptions that would allow science to participate in a worldview that satisfies higher human needs. It has led modern scientists to claim that it is absurd to say that concepts and ideas belong to the real world in the same way as active forces and matter occupying space. For such minds, concepts and ideas are products of the human brain, and nothing more. The scholastics still understood the nature of these matters, but modern science despises scholasticism without knowing what it is, especially which aspect of scholasticism was sound and which was not. What was sound about scholasticism was the feeling that concepts and ideas are not merely fantasies invented by the human mind to understand reality, but that they are connected in some way with the things themselves, even more so than matter and force. This healthy scholastic sensibility was a legacy of the grand views of Plato and Aristotle. What was unhealthy about scholasticism, on the other hand, was that this feeling became mixed with conceptions that entered the medieval development of Christianity. This development claimed that an otherworldly and therefore unknowable God was the source of all spiritual realities, including concepts and ideas. It depended on faith in something that is not of this world. A healthy human mind, on the other hand, adheres to this world and has no need of any other. But it also imbues this world with spirit. Such a mind attributes worldly reality to concepts and ideas, just as it does to the things and events of the sensory world. Greek philosophy flowed from this healthy thinking, and scholasticism retained an intimation of it. But scholasticism tried to reinterpret it so that it would correspond to an otherworldly Christian faith. Concepts and ideas were no longer considered the most profound thing that human beings could behold in the processes of this world. Rather, it was God and the other world. Once we apprehend the idea of something, we have no need to look further for its source, in quotes, for we have found what satisfies the human need for knowledge. But what did the scholastics care about such a need for knowledge? They wanted to preserve what they saw as the Christian view of God. They wanted to find the source of the world in an otherworldly God, even though their search for the inner being of things led only to concepts and ideas. Subsection 9. Over the centuries, Christian concepts became more powerful than the fading feeling handed down from Greek antiquity. People lost their intuitive sense for the reality of concepts and ideas. In the process, they lost their sense for spirit itself. People began to worship the purely material. Newton's era began in the natural sciences. There was no longer any talk of the unity that underlies the world's multiplicity. All unity was denied and degraded to a merely, quote, in quotes, human notion. In nature, people saw only a multiplicity, an aggregate of particulars. It was this fundamental view that led Newton to see light not as a primal unity, but as something composite. In his title Materials for a History of Color Theory, Goethe described aspects of this historical development. It becomes clear that the conceptions of more recent science have led to unsound views in the realm of color theory. This science no longer understands light as one of nature's qualities. This is the reason science does not know why, under certain circumstances, light appears colored, or how color arises within the realm of light. The end of chapter 17.